Welcome to the More Perfect Union, the podcast that offers real debate without the hate. Hi, I'm Kevin Kelton, and with me are...
I'm DJ McGuire, a progressive conservative from Suffolk, Virginia.
I'm Greg Matuszek, a common sense liberal from Cincinnati, Ohio.
I'm Rebecca Kuschmider, a progressive feminist from Kensington, Maryland.
And I like to think of myself as a passionate moderate living in Los Angeles, California. I know I'm living in Los Angeles, California. And I think I am. And before we get into the news of the day, which is mucho newso, we wanted to mention our website, moreperfectunion.com, where not only can you find our podcast, but you can find written commentary about us that we post during the week. Rebecca, you posted a couple of articles this week that you call Pop Goes the Political Culture. And I thought those were pretty fun reads. Got any more coming?
I do. I'm picking fun sort of pop culture, less serious news that comes down the pike every day and writing some of it up. And it's coming across as pretty shrill feminism stuff. So very much like me.
And who doesn't want that in their lives?
I think we all need more shrill feminism. It should be part of our, you know, like there should be a U.S. daily allotment of shrill feminism that the USDA hands down to us.
So as shrill. We record this, it is primary day in the United States of America, and there are at least four states that are having primaries with big contests, including Ohio, where Greg, you want to tell us what's going to happen there?
Oh, it's the big race, and it's over. As far as governor, it's going to be Mike DeWine versus Cordray. Cordray, as we all remember, was head of the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau.
Right,
Richard Cordray. Not his brother, Pierre Cordray, which we...
Not comic Rob
There's
Cordray.
Also Rob Cordray, the comedian.
Oh, of course, I'm sorry. Yeah, no, I'm just being a smartass. Now I'm going to say Rob Cordray for the rest of the show.
I know, it's hard. It's very confusing. People shouldn't be allowed to have the same name as anyone who's appeared on The Daily Show. Sorry.
Exactly. And DeWine beat that asshole Kasich's lieutenant governor.
How can you be sensible if you always refer to your own state's governor as an asshole?
I don't. I've only done this for like the past 8 years.
Oh, okay.
So,
in Greg's defense, Kasich is kind of an asshole.
Oh, is. The man tried to get the movie Fargo banned from Blockbuster. So that's an asshole move. Anywho, DeWine, who's our attorney general, beat Mary Taylor, who is a little bit crazy. But she spent the past 6 months distancing herself from that asshole Kasich and calling herself the Trumpiest Trump who's ever Trumped. But DeWine has spent these past 6 months saying, no, I'm the Trumpiest Trump who's ever Trumped. And it's been fascinating seeing as DeWine has said, well, you were part of that whole expand Medicare thing that happened in Ohio. And she said, well, that wasn't me. That was Kasich, asshole. You are going to have to bleep me so much. And it's just, and I've seen this trend a lot in Ohio, where each conservative, each GOP person is saying, look at me. I'm the Trump candidate, I can't see them doing this in the midterm, in the actual election in November.
Time will tell. We're going to be talking about the midterms in a little bit. But the other marquee race tonight was in West Virginia.
But before you get there, Kevin, I just want to say one thing about Ohio. My apologies. The more important thing to come out of Ohio was that the Democrats rejected the Russia Today guest and Bashar Assad-backing Denis Kucinich. He crashed and burned, just like the Cuyahoga River when he was mayor.
He was also backed by the Sanders gang, the Burton Bros, and Cordray was backed by Elizabeth Warren. Does this portend anything for 2020?
Yeah, it does. Yeah. What it says is, if you are too close to Russia, you will not get nominated by the Democratic Party. And that is a very good thing.
Yes.
Because if you're going to talk about all of the dangers of Donald Trump's collaboration with the Putin regime, and there are many of them, you can't put up candidates who have their own blind spots about Russia. And while Sanders himself may or may not have a blind spot about Russia, most of his friends, Dennis Kucinich, Tulsi Gabbard out of Hawaii, whose name I probably mispronounced, and I'm sorry for that, but she is also a friend of Bashar Assad, and all the various other friends of Bashar Assad and Vladimir Putin that are out there, Democrats can't nominate them.
You know,
and I'm very glad that the Ohio Democrats didn't nominate this one.
So I believe 20%.
What does all this portend for the midterms? And even we can look forward to 2020. But let's just talk about the midterms. Is there any takeaway tonight?
As what I've seen is the numbers have been pretty good as far as turnout for even a primary. They've been promising.
Is it a good Democratic turnout or turnout across the board?
I saw as a turnout across the board. No, I could be wrong.
Well, because Democrats fall off in non-presidential years. We're bad at midterms. So if turnout is good across the board, that's good news. That means Democrats aren't staying home.
Exactly.
So the question now is what happened, you know, what happens in November? Again, I think Cordray's win is a very good sign for the party, because I hate to put it this way, but the moderates are winning. And in primaries, that's a good thing. I remember when I was a Republican, 2014 was the Republicans' best midterm year. And that was because the moderates kept winning primaries and nominating contests. That doesn't mean moderates should win all the time. You have to look at the constituency you're dealing with. But for a constituency like Ohio, Cordray is, I think, a better fit than Kucinich.
Again,
Assad and Russia thing doesn't help. But it just doesn't. I'm sorry.
Right.
No, well, you're right.
I mean, but Kucinich has an extensive history in Ohio politics. He has a record. And it's not consistent with current values. Right. Assad aside.
Right. And that. And
which is
and
the name of my college band. Assad aside.
Funny. And, you know, I think, you know, Democrats are being sensible in their nominations. And that's going to mean bigger and better results in November.
Yes, but let's, you know, from my reading of what's happening today, Republicans are also being a little bit more sensible by rejecting people like Don Blankenship. And that means that we're going to have some pretty tough races, even though we keep hearing about the Democratic wave. And again, I want to make it clear that Democrats are going to win more seats. There is going to be a Democratic wave. The only question is, will the Democrats win enough seats to take control of the House of Representatives? And, you know, we've touched on this this topic before. I happen to think that the Democrats need a cohesive national message. I know, Rebecca, you feel a little differently, and we had an interesting back and forth on this on Facebook and on Fire this week.
Yeah, there was a piece in, was it The Hill or Politico? I'm not remembering where the link was that I found, but it was an opinion piece by former Representative Steve Israel of New York about what Democrats need to do to win in individual races. And there's this feeling that Democrats don't have a good central message. We don't have a national rallying cry. And Israel says, and I've been saying this for a few weeks on this podcast, that's not necessary, because what resonates in a district in suburban New York is not going to resonate in a district in Ohio. The concerns are different, and we need to sort of set aside the ridiculous, you know, trying to run against Trump idea, and representatives or candidates need to really talk to the people that they will be serving about the things that concern them. You know, talk about the overpass that needs to be repaired. Talk about education and, you know, and concerns about the schools. Talk about things that are quite parochial. And then, you know, once we've his quote, which you like, Kevin, was win first, we'll talk later. And I do agree with him. I think that's an effective strategy, that if you continue talking about the things that are tangible your potential constituents, you connect with them in a really valuable way.
Right. And so I'm going to take the opposite position. And I want to preface this by saying Steve Israel is a very smart guy. And I understand what he's saying, and I understand what you're saying.
Well, keep in mind, Steve Israel knows how to lose midterm elections really effectively. He headed up the D trip in 2010 and 2014, and things did not go well. So when you know, if what he's saying is the opposite of what he did when he was mounting strategy, then we should definitely do that.
Well, here's why I think the win first, then we'll talk strategy is a big mistake. I think the Democrats should do both. I don't see why you can't, why one precludes the other. You run, yes, you run on local issues, especially issues that are going to resonate in your specific district, but you can also have a national theme. It doesn't have to be a specific policy that, you know, Republicans are then going to turn around. I'm not saying that they should be running on gun control. Because obviously that's not going to play in a lot of districts
that's
in red
states.
That's
not a winning strategy.
No, that's rough, I'm not saying that.
But I do think that having a message about how the Democratic Party would, you know, would enhance the economy, reform the tax plan that has been put in place by the Republicans, which is a travesty, you know, how we can make taxes more fair, how we can create more economic opportunity, what we would do in terms of social justice. I think those things should be national messages that can then be complemented by local messages. Here's why I'm really concerned about this win first, then we'll talk strategy. People seem to think that just because Conor Lamb was able to pull out a win in PA-18 by the thinnest of margins, and that Doug Jones was able to defeat Roy Moore in Georgia by maybe a point and a half, they think that, oh, if we just do what we've been doing because the country has moved away from Trump, we'll be fine with local issues. Conor Lamb ran on local issues. Doug Jones ran on local issues. Here's the thing. Doug Jones beat a known pedophile and a crazy person. Conor Lamb won, like I said, by a whisker when Donald Trump's poll numbers were at their worst. As we all know now, Trump is starting to consolidate his numbers. He's actually ticking up in the polls. And who knows what's going to happen with this Iran deal, which we're going to be talking about in a minute, or if he's able to bring home with Mike Pompeo, if Pompeo is able to bring home the three North Korean hostages, and then he goes over there, has a summit, the North Koreans sign a peace treaty, Trump takes credit for it, the economy is still humming come October. Who knows what the landscape is going to look like?
Well, Kevin, to your point that yes, there should be an umbrella message that we're all standing under, but we can't let that be the only message. It has to be, we are going to improve the economy and build a new wing on the library.
Right. Let's build a new wing on the library, and let's have a national infrastructure plan. That's what I'm saying.
Infrastructure Week. Let's do it. Finally. Look, Democrats will actually have an infrastructure week. That's the message. Boom. We just won this sucker.
The other thing we have to recognize is that the Republicans are going to have their own strategy. And the Republicans are essentially, the impression I get is that the Republicans, particularly in the House races, have essentially decided they are going to nationalize their election. And what they're essentially going to say is that a Democratic Congress will impeach Donald Trump in an attempt to get their base riled up.
A Nancy Pelosi,
because that's about the only
Democratic
thing they have
Congress.
Left. Or they'll try to run against Nancy Pelosi, which has never actually worked.
Yeah.
They thought it worked in 2010 and 2014 because they kept, what they were really doing was convincing themselves that they were running against Pelosi when they were really running against Obama. So there's no Obama to run against, so that's not going to work.
And Nancy Pelosi knows it doesn't work, and she also is more than willing to take the hits in the media. She, you know, if it means bad headlines, but races won, she'll take it. She'll let Democratic candidates run against her. She is more than willing to be the stalking horse for all of this.
I thought the Republicans already are running under the drain the swamp. I thought that was their whole thing.
They drained the swamp. They drained it, and we wound up with Scott Pruitt. He was what was at the bottom of the swamp.
I think they stocked the swamp. That's what I think they did.
Yeah, they just like the game preserves where Don Jr. hunts.
Yeah, but take a look at the elections last year, and they give us they give us a good idea of what to do and what not to do, because the Democrats won all three high profile races. This is true. But if you look at the races in particular, Northam ran arguably the least nationalized race. He ran on local issues. There were statewide issues that he addressed.
Virginia governor, just for our audience.
Right, Ralph Northam running for Virginia governor. And his margin of victory was actually larger than Hillary Clinton's, despite it being an off-year election. And that's in absolute votes, not just in share of the vote, where he's much higher. Whereas up in New Jersey and in New York, the candidate for governor of New Jersey essentially didn't really run much of a campaign at all. He just bashed Chris Christie, who was highly unpopular. And he ended up getting about the same share of the vote as Hillary Clinton did. Bill de Blasio tried the national campaign. He tried to tell everyone, vote for me as an anti-Trump vote. And he was actually six points worse than Hillary Clinton in New York City. He did 4 points worse than he did when he ran for his first term. So the fact of the matter is, an overarching national campaign is going to be forced on Democrats by the Republicans anyway, because the Republicans will basically say, vote Democrat and Trump will be impeached. And Democrats will have to respond, well, if the evidence is for it, yeah, we'll see what happens. And, you know, that bats that away. But, you know, Conor Lamb, and I'm going off on a tangent here, but Conor Lamb, as much as he ran to appeal to rural Democrats and all, Conor Lamb won because of the suburban part of his district. Doug Jones won because of the suburban areas of Alabama voting for him. It's the suburbs that will be the salvation for the Democrats. And that means not just focusing on issues that matter to suburbans, but it also means recognizing that there are a lot of Republicans in the suburbs who do not like Donald Trump, and who would be more than willing to cross over if the Democrats present them with a good message. So I don't mind a message. What I do mind, though, is the message cannot be how far left can we run on economic issues,
right, right,
because it's not going to win over suburban voters. We need to talk about trade and Trump's protectionism. We need to talk about Trump's runaway deficits. We need to talk about the fact that he keeps saying he's going to get a handle on spending and he doesn't. These are things that can appeal to – these are issues that I think that can appeal to these moderate suburbans, these moderate Republicans in the suburbs, without giving the base too much heartburn if we play it right. Because that's the key. You don't want to give your base too much heartburn.
Well, the person to listen to right now, my girl, Kyrsten Sinema out of Arizona, she's running for Jeff Flake's seat. She's the Democrat. And she just did a really fantastic interview on Pod Save America a couple of weeks ago. And they flat out asked her, hey, do you find people wanting to talk about Donald Trump when you're on the campaign trail? She's like, you know, no, they're distracted by it. And they really want to talk about stuff that's important to Arizona. Now, she's running in a very Republican state. She's been serving in the House in a very Republican district, or a very conservative Democratic district. And she has a really good sense of how to message to suburban, more conservative, but not Trumpian voters. And I really liked listening to her because she was able to talk about the effects of the changes to the healthcare bill and what they had been trying to do prior to the slash and burn politics and, you know, effects on business owners and all of that. She's doing a really good job with balancing what's happening on the national stage with how it's affecting her constituents very directly. It's worth a listen. It was a couple weeks ago on Pod Save America, but her name is Kyrsten Sinema. I have total girl crush on her. I love her.
Okay, great. So let's talk about some of the other news, and not just news of the week, but news of the last several hours. Trump pulled out. News today.
Hot off the presses.
I know. I feel like Rachel Maddow here today. You know how she's been throwing out her show at makeup chair.
Start all over again.
Here we are.
So speaking of throwing things out, the Iran nuclear deal, well, Trump's out of it. I don't know whether the entire deal has been scrapped. Apparently, it can still stay together if the other four nations and Iran can decide to continue it. But the United States is going to start now issuing new sanctions, which is going to hurt Iran and also hurt U.S. businesses. But then I heard that other countries may step up to replace those deals to help Iran. So, again, where do you think we're going with this?
It's a hell in a handbasket.
No. So, first of all, let's talk about the concept of why would any country ever enter any sort of deal with us ever again? And I'm looking at you, North Korea, if this is what's going to happen. I mean, this is terrible. It just makes America look bad. It makes Trump look bad. It's just the worst. I can't say enough how disappointed I am.
Trump pulled out
this.
Of the climate accord. He's pulling right. out of this. He pulled out of he wants to get out of NAFTA. He hasn't honored a single American deal. Who knows whether he'll stay in NATO, you know?
Oh, I know. But, okay, I'm going to ask DJ now to tell me how wrong I am. DJ.
Okay, well, I will say that I am not going to shed any tears for the Iran deal itself. I think I thought it was a bad deal then. I think it is a bad deal now. The one thing that Trump said, probably maybe the first thing that Trump has said that is correct in months, if not years, is that this deal was essentially what he said was there is no way to prevent Iran from becoming a nuclear power under this deal. And I think he's right about that. I don't think this deal prevents Iran from becoming a nuclear power. At best, it delays it. And that assumes we take Iran at their word when they say they're holding to the agreement. There are enough regimes out there, including Russia and China, who are more than willing to help Iran become a nuclear power along the way, whether we're inside the deal or whether we're outside the deal.
Again, assuming that the Iranians won't want to renegotiate the deal completely with the U.S. out of it and threatening sanctions, they could very easily go to the European signatories and say, all right, game's changed. And then they start over, but without the U.S. at the table. It's stupid strategy. You know, he's attempting to treat this like selling or buying granite countertops, the same analogy you've used, DJ. And this isn't like buying granite countertops. It's different.
And on top of that, Iran knows, the regime knows that they can get just about any weapon they want because their old weapon salesman, Ali North, is now heading up the NRA.
We're right back there.
It is symptomatic of this administration's complete lack of strategy. There is no strategy in place to help the Iranian people take their country back from the mullahs who have effectively imprisoned them and run their country into the ground for 40 years. Because Donald Trump doesn't know what strategy is. Donald Trump is interested in owning the news cycle for the next 24 hours to the next 7 days. He's not interested in the long slog of putting together a policy, planning for its implementation, and monitoring it and seeing how well it works. It's the difference between him and previous Republican administrations, let alone previous Democratic administrations, who would, you know, they would announce a policy and then they would announce updates on that policy because, you know, real policy takes time to implement. Trump doesn't understand that. He's all about the headlines.
Yeah.
Well, do you think there's a bunch of Norwegians
right
now?
He gets a briefing book every goddamn night and he doesn't read it. And that's the most appalling thing I've ever heard, because how can you get the most interesting classified information in the world handed to you once a day and not want to read it?
Oh, there's a cheeseburger.
I want to read it.
I want to read it.
That's awesome.
The More Perfect Union, real debate without the hate, now heard on iTunes and Blog Talk Radio.
Okay, so now let's talk about a relatively sad story, which is this Eric Schneiderman resignation, the Attorney General of New York. And boy, did that go from 0 to 60 seconds in less than 60 seconds.
Yeah, well, you know what, Democrats, good job. We policed our own. The guy was bad news and goodbye. He's gone. You know, okay. I don't know what the conversation between him and Andrew Cuomo sounded like, but I heard the door slam at the end of it. So,
yeah, you know, the issue was that through the whole thing, he's like, look, not me. I didn't do it. I wasn't. And then he goes, but I'm quitting. Goodbye.
Yeah, you know, because that means there's more and worse to come. That's yeah, all that ever means.
It was pretty clear from his statement and from the contemporaneous reports from friends of the people who backed their statements. It was pretty clear that he had some major problems in his relationships.
Right. And we've talked about
this. He was trying to say that it was role play. I'm sorry.
Oh, that's creepy. Yeah. But we've talked about this with the Me Too movement. Is one and mostly, and when I say we, this has been an issue with the concept of false accusations, and there's no trials, and it's like, okay, it's done. You've been accused. Now your career is over. And to be quite honest, I don't have that much sympathy when 20 people come out of the woodwork and say, look, this has been going on. And they go, oh, I just don't see where this is happening.
Hold on, Greg. I'm gonna kind of call you on that one. And I've been thinking all day of how to postulate this, if that's the right word.
Sure.
Without insulting our audience, because you know, as you guys well remember, back when the Al Franken charges first started to come out, we did a show, and there were some comments about Leanne Tweeden. And people felt that I was slut-shaming her because, you know, I simply asked some questions. I pointed out that she did some things with Robin Williams in the same USO tour. And people were very offended, and I understand that. And I don't want to duplicate that experience. Listen, I think Eric Schneiderman had to go. And I applaud the women who came forward. It takes a lot of bravery. And the reporting that went behind it, you know, it – the world is a better place today than it was yesterday before this broke.
I agree.
That said, I'm still concerned that we're creating a new kind of courtroom, a public courtroom, that these things are being adjudicated in the court of public opinion. I was very happy today to read that two different attorneys' offices in New York, you know, prosecutors' offices in New York, are looking into the Schneiderman situation and may eventually press charges against him.
Yeah, well said.
That is the place where all of these cases need to be moved. I'm a little concerned, and again, I'm not defending Schneiderman. I'm not defending any of these other names that we could go back and talk about. I'm still a little concerned that we are on the precipice of a McCarthy-like situation in this country, where people will destroy people with maybe allegations that aren't as credible or with political motives behind them. And it's very easy. Listen, a lot of us liked Eric Schneiderman before yesterday. I'm not afraid to say I liked Anthony Weiner as a politician. I once had him as one of my heroes on my Facebook page until we learned about the other side of him.
Right.
And a lot of people liked Bill Cosby. You know, a lot of people liked Bill O'Reilly before these things came out. But you learn to live with it. Al Franken, too. And then you learn, you say, okay, well, there's another side. But at some point, this is going to metastasize, and it's going to start consuming people that we really care about with maybe much flimsier allegations. And so, again, let me just finish this, DJ, and then I'd love to hear your point of view. I'm not criticizing any women. I think it's great that people are finally coming forward, and I know it still takes a tremendous amount of bravery and courage to do it. But we need to start bringing these charges to the police. We need to start pressing charges, and we need to start adjudicating sexual accusations in the courts of law, not in the court of public opinion. DJ, what's your take?
Yeah. The fact of the matter is, though, when you're dealing, particularly when you're dealing with elected officials, you can't tell the public to just put pause on everything until the legal machinery goes through. And the fact of the matter is, in all of the cases that we've talked about, it has not been a situation of one accusation against a particular politician. It has been multiple accusations. You know, we went through the Rolling Stone fiasco. In fact, all of this has been after the Rolling Stone UVA article fiasco. And yet, not a single high-profile person has been able to show their quote-unquote innocence. The closest thing we may actually come to that could be not even in this country. It could be in Ontario, where Patrick Brown is attempting to sue the television station that presented accusations of two women without naming them. And even that's looking really dubious based on some of the other information that's coming out there. What I have seen from the court of public opinion is that the court of public opinion does not respond to just one accusation, but the court of public opinion does respond to multiple accusations, because they tend to assume that if multiple women are saying it, then it's probably true. And they're going to keep thinking that until a situation arises where multiple women have been shown to be false. Until that actually happens, the court of public opinion is going to simply look at past experience and say, well, when two or three women have said it, they haven't been wrong before. And they're going to keep maintaining that until two or three women are wrong or two or three women are false. And it's just as much as we may be concerned for whenever that day comes, it hasn't arrived yet. And I don't think we should allow our fear of a future conspiratorial effort to take down a politician get in the way of our common sense that says when multiple women are making this accusation, the accusation is probably correct.
And the other thing to think about is that women have agency and women have cognition and women have the ability to think through the consequences of their actions. And perhaps there are women who are willing to make up allegations to take down a prominent man just because they want to. They're not a lot of them, though. And women know what's going to happen if they go on the record with a Ronan Farrow and tell their story in the New Yorker. They know. They've thought it through. Trust that they have thought through the consequences and they know what they are about to do to a human being, and trust also that they think it's worth it. And on that, and mentioning Ronan Farrow, he keeps bringing down these sexual predators with his reporting, and yet he can't bring down the one in his own family. He must be so frustrated that he just took down Eric Schneiderman, and Woody Allen is walking around being a schmuck.
I think what Ronan, and this is very unfortunate, I would even say tragic, is that the court of public opinion rendered its verdict on Woody Allen when he started dating his adopted daughter. And we just, people are just largely, unfortunately, they're inured to it now. And when they hear accusations aimed at Woody Allen, they just go, well, yeah, they probably happened. What are you going to do? And that last point is probably wrong. There probably is some way that Woody Allen can be brought to justice. But most Americans can't really figure out how that is for something that happened 30 to 40 years ago, unless the statute of limitations gets changed, which it may very well happen.
It's happening in LA. They are changing statutes of limitations in Los Angeles. If they would do it in New York or wherever the hell Dylan Farrow was living at the time.
If they do it in New York, then some ambitious attorney will probably prosecute Woody Allen. And more power to whoever that ambitious attorney is.
Yeah, go with God, attorney.
You have to get Albany to change the law. You have to get Albany to do the right thing. And well, that costs more money than I have right now, let me tell you.
Maybe we could just introduce Eric Schneiderman to Woody Allen, and then Eric can slap him around a little bit.
Yeah, God. Ew. That's not a picture
letters,
I need in my head.
We get letters. Okay, so on to happier topics. Let's talk about the NRA, which has a new president this week.
Oh, hell.
Ollie North from the
Iran-Contra
deal.
Always an arms dealer.
Ollie North, the guy that, how much time did he do in prison? I think did he serve time?
No, I don't think so.
He appealed his conviction. and the conviction got thrown out.
A man of no convictions.
You remember when he ran for the Senate, DJ?
I do.
In Virginia? I was still in Lynchburg then. That was something.
I lived in Williamsburg, and as I said on social media, I think 2 days ago, I voted for Oliver North in 1994, and I convinced my then fiance to vote for Oliver North in 1994. And looking back, my first divorce now looks inevitable.
Yeah, I was still a New York registered voter in those days, and I did not get to vote against Ollie North. I didn't cancel you out, Deej.
Well, enough other voters did, because Oliver North did not get elected to the United States Senate.
No, he did. Who did? Was that George Wilder?
That's Chuck Robb.
Chuck Robb, all right. Okay.
Going back to the premise at hand, the NRA has needed a new president, needed a new face, okay? And they said, hey, you know who the kids could relate to, because we're having a problem with the kids, you know, would be someone who is convicted of betraying their country, you know, 35 years ago and selling arms to the Middle East, 30 years, and selling weapons, high-grade weapons to the Middle East. Ollie North. Kids dig Ollie North.
You know what? The guy that used to have this job was Charlton Heston. He was no spring chicken. So no, they like these old right-wing guys.
At least he was an actor. At least he ran around town screaming about cannibalism. And, you know, I mean...
Yeah, from my cold, dead hands. Or
whatever. You can have my gun when you pry it from my cold, dead hands.
I get that, but... You
Assault
know.
Soylent is people.
People don't remember Soylent Green. You have to go to Planet of the Apes for Charlton Heston.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, it's true.
There's some of us who are sci-fi geeks. We do remember Soylent Green.
Yeah, exactly. Who was the president before Ollie? Who's been the president?
An old white guy. They all look the same to us.
The only real job an NRA president has is to reappoint Wayne LaPierre as the executive vice president so he can actually run the organization. That's it. You've done your job, and you can go fade away now.
So that Wayne LaPierre's Twitter account would conveniently break every time there's a school shooting. Oh, somehow it's just not working. There's another mass shooting. I would like to send something out about how I was going to send out thoughts and prayers, but I can't. Wireless.
And this is just another example, as if we needed another one, of the continued marginalization of this organization. It has become the caricature that so many on the left have portrayed it as for years. It essentially said, okay, fine, we'll be that. And they are that. And it's just, you know, for someone who is sympathetic to gun rights, it's painful to watch. It's just, you know, they're going to continue to lose arguments politically, and they're going to deserve to lose arguments politically, because they're not interested in arguing anymore. They're just interested in sticking the middle finger to people who disagree with them.
Well, you know, and their problem is when they started taking gun manufacturers as members instead of individuals, if they would get back to their original mission of teaching, you know, hunters how not to shoot their buddy in the face like Dick Cheney, they'd be great. That's a valid mission. Like, yeah,
right.
Don't shoot the guy in the face. All of us are for that, but they started becoming the advocacy arm of the gun manufacturing industry, and the profit motive came into play. And as we all know, the profit motive makes things a little screwy.
All right, with that in mind, with that in mind,
feminists.
I know,
I'm killing the worst.
Well, let's follow up with what Rebecca was saying here, and we're trying to help the NRA here. Who would we elect if we had it our way? Who would we elect as the NRA's new president?
Kanye
would be great. Oh my gosh, that beats who I was going to say.
What were you going to say?
I was going to say Tom Selleck, because
is he a gun guy?
Oh my gosh, he's got a gun named after him. It's called the Quigley.
Really?
He's got a whole, he's like a whole big gun guy. I think he goes to NRA things so that people can like touch his mustache and get healed. I mean, oh yeah.
I know who it should be.
Who should it be?
Childish Gambino.
Oh, yes. Childish. There's nothing he can't do. Dang it. Oh, I agree.
Well, with that, listen, we want to thank everybody for listening. It's been a fun podcast for us. Please follow us on Twitter at hashtag at MPU Podcast. and on Facebook at facebook.com/moreperfectunionpodcast. And if you'd be so kind to share our link on your Facebook timeline and tell your friends to check us out, we'd appreciate it. And if you would like to talk politics with us between shows, why don't you look to our Facebook group, Open Fire Politics. You can join. We're all there. There's a lot of really smart people discussing politics every day, and we'd love to have you join us. And with that, everybody, what is going to be the hot news story of the week that's going to probably break 13 minutes after we end tonight?
They're going to find out that Dennis Kucinich is actually two small children standing on each other's shoulders.
Wearing an overcoat.
With an overcoat. And he's going to ask for a recount based on that.
Dennis Kucinich may have lost an election tonight, but he still gets to go home to a really hot wife. I mean, she's amazing. Have you guys ever seen her?
That's right. That tall, redheaded wife. Oh, and she could, yeah.
Yeah, you know what? To have a wife that much more attractive than you are, you have to be charming. Trust me, I know. Because my wife did not marry me for my looks, that's for sure.